Welcome to DivCasts from the University of Chicago Divinity School. For more of our podcasts and information about our terms of use, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts.
Nice to see you all. Thank you for coming. I actually can say I know every single person in the room, which is unusual at the University of Chicago since I'm not from the University of Chicago. So thank you all so much for coming to the workshop entitled Secularism and the Citizen in the Middle East and South Asia. I'd like to first take the opportunity to thank the Mellon Islamic Studies Initiative at the Divinity School, and in particular the steering committee of Professor Sells, Professor Donner, Professor Qutbuddin, and Professor Nirenberg, who graciously invited me to spend a quarter here at the University of Chicago. I'd also like to specially thank Nora Jacobson, Ben Hamad, who've put in countless hours, although I hope she's counting, and done so much to make my time here productive and enjoyable, not to mention managing the entire workshop. So thank you very much, Nora. It's a pleasure to be here today and at the University of Chicago. When I was asked to organize a conference for my stay here, I decided to take the opportunity to invite those scholars whose work has been so influential to my own, partly as a tribute to their scholarship, partly to have an opportunity to talk with them after only reading them from afar, as it were, but also to share their seminal contributions with students here at the university. Each one of these scholars has paved the way in their own fields, and I'm delighted that they have agreed to share a couple of days with us here at the University of Chicago. So the workshop has been organized in conjunction with the seminar I'm currently teaching, where we read these and other scholars' work on theorizing secularism, but also more fundamentally, in grappling with a very complex and theoretically challenging field of religion in some of its various manifestations. The workshop was designed specially for my students, in particular as a way of facilitating conversation with the very distinguished scholars whose work they've been engaging with in class and employing to great benefit in their own research. We have here a range of disciplines represented, from political science to anthropology, sociology, and European intellectual history, which I think nicely captures the increasingly disciplinary cross-fertilization in academe, but also the necessarily multifaceted approach to the study of religion. So I do appreciate the symbolic significance of hosting this particular event here at the Divinity School. As this is also likely to be my last opportunity to hold the floor, I'd like to formally thank Holly Schisler, whose idea it was to invite me here. We finally, after so many years of talking about it, actually embarked on a joint research adventure. And also to Aisha Polat, PhD candidate at the Divinity School, for sharing so much of her valuable time, and yes, when you're writing your thesis, every minute is valuable, helping me to learn Ottoman. Nobody ever accused the faculty and students of the U of C of not being productive, especially in the winter term. So in terms of logistics, we've devoted a full hour to each speaker, with the expectation that the speaker will present for approximately 30, 35 minutes, leaving plenty of time for questions, discussion, and conversation. We've also made sure to punctuate the workshop with very civilized coffee and lunch breaks to allow us as much time as possible for more informal chances to engage with the speakers and, of course, with each other. As a special note of appreciation for our guests, one of the students from the seminar will introduce each speaker. And I'm unfortunately the bearer of the bad news that Professor Bayat will not be able to join the workshop after all, as he and we intended. So as MCs are wont to say, without further ado, I'll pass the mantle over to Gwendolyn Bellinger, MA student in Middle East Studies in the Social Sciences Division here at the university, who will introduce Dr. Hepper.
Okay. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Hepper, who is visiting Chicago today from Turkey and has kindly agreed to present his talk titled Some Notes on Secularism in Turkey. Dr. Hepper received his PhD from Syracuse University in New York and has had numerous fellowships and professorships at many major universities in Turkey, the United States, Israel, and the United Kingdom. He currently serves as a professor in the Department of Political Science at Belkent University in Ankara, as well as provost in the Office of Vice Rector in Academic Affairs and director in the Center of Turkish Politics and History. He is also a founding and honorary member of the Turkish Academy of Sciences. His enormous contribution to the field of secularism and Islam in Turkey is illustrated in the wealth of his published articles, including such work as The State, Religion, and Pluralism, The Turkish Case and Comparative Perspective, The Victory of the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, and The Conservative Democratic Government by Pious People, The Justice and Development Party in Turkey. In his most recent work, Does Secularism in Turkey Face a Real Threat?, Dr. Hepper explores the success in the cognitive revolution instigated by the founders of the Turkish Republic and argues that Turkish people, religious and non-religious alike, have developed a strong loyalty to the secular republic. He suggests that those who identify as pious voluntarily separate religion and politics, and therefore their loyalties to the secular state do not contradict their religiosity. And so without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Dr. Hepper.
It's my pleasure and privilege to be at Chicago University. I used to come to Chicago so very often in the past, so I'm here again. I like this hall. It's like I feel like I'm in Oxford or Cambridge. The title of the presentation I had shared with the organizers of this conference was Some Notes on Secularism in Turkey. In the process, I changed it to Some Preliminary Notes on Secularism and Secularism in Turkey. I have been asked by a UK publisher some years ago to write a book entitled Secularism, Islam, and Democracy in Turkey. And I said, I can do it very easily, no problem. You know, so many people have written on this. I have made some contributions myself. And then, you know, I would come up with a grand summary of all this, and the publisher would be very much pleased about it. But then, you know, I started to think that if I do that, I would not really be making any contribution at all. You know, I would be just repeating what others have written, what I've written. And some people may be familiar with it, like her. So, you know, she would ask, or these people ask the question, why I have written a book. But as I was thinking about it, one day, in fact, I was shaving one morning. Then I thought, well, there is this polarization in Turkey between the what I call radical secularists on the one hand and the pious on the other. There are two other groups. There are moderate secularists in Turkey and also Islamists. But there is this great debate between the radical secularists and the pious. So much so that the members from these two groups just cannot get together and be engaged in a meaningful debate. It has become almost impossible for them to carry out sort of a dialogical debate. They don't listen to each other. They don't want to learn anything from each other. My question is, how have we come to this point? And of course, it wasn't really like this before 2002, before the Justice and Development Party came to office. The radical seculars, of course, are arguing that the present government in Turkey, the government in Turkey since 2002, the Justice and Development Party government and its leaders, eventually will bring back a state based on Islam. Whereas those leaders and the Justice and Development Party argue that the members of that political party and those leaders are really practicing Muslims, but they prefer secular politics. And I think there is a truth in this. You know, the Justice and Development Party governments have been in office for quite some time. They have not turned against the West. On the whole, you know, there are harmonious relations between Turkey and the United States, between Turkey and the United Kingdom, until recently even between Turkey and Israel. And this political party have been obtaining more and more votes from 2002 to 2011. In 2002, their votes were 34%. It went up to 46% in 2007, and then 2011 even 49.9%. They must be honest when they say we are practicing Muslims, but we prefer secular politics. When we look at the people who are giving their votes for them. Now, in Turkey, people are not voting, have not been voting for quite some time for political parties just because they are religiously oriented political parties. When you ask people whether or not, you know, they would be receptive to a state based on Islam, based on Sharia, more than 80% of them says no. When you look at the remaining 20%, only 9% of them would support men marrying more than one woman. And when you ask them, if a woman has been engaged in adultery, should that woman be published according to Islamic rules? That percentage even drops to 2%. So it's not surprising though that they are not really voting for Justice and Development Party just because it is a religiously oriented political party. Since 2002, for instance, we have two religiously oriented political parties in Turkey. The so-called Felicity Party and the Justice and Development Party. Felicity Party introduces itself as a religiously oriented political party, whereas the Justice and Development Party considers itself as a conservative democratic. And the Felicity Party has been obtaining votes in those three elections no higher than 3%. To what extent people are tolerant toward each other when it comes to practicing their religion? Again, some reliable nationwide surveys indicate that there is a great deal of tolerance on this matter. For instance, if you ask people the following question, if a person believes in God or Allah, in Islam's case, and his prophet, would you still consider that person a Muslim? If that person, for instance, does not practice his or her religion, does not go on the pilgrimage, does not fast, 82-83% of the people considers that person still a Muslim. So what I am concluding from all this and from some other findings that in Turkey, one really cannot talk of a political Islam if political Islam is an Islam that people would prefer, if people want to have a state based on Islam. That's political Islam as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, religions play different roles at different levels. You know, you may have religion playing a role at the level of the state. That's what I call political Islam. Religions may play a role at the level of the society or community. And religions may play a role only at the level of the individual. So I therefore make a distinction between piety and Islamism. And I call people pious people who are Muslims, who practice their religion, who derive some virtues for them from their religion, but they don't insist that others should have the same conception of religion as they themselves. They should not insist that others should practice their religion as they do. And of course, they are not after a state based on Islam. And it seems to me that most of the people have this particular conception of Islam in Turkey. So does the Justice and Development Party and its leaders. But we have some secularists in Turkey. They think it is all takiyye, it is all simulation, that these people may not show their true face, but there is an ulterior motive here. They may hide it, but whenever the time is ripe, they will try to bring back to Turkey a state based on Islam. Now, as far as these people are concerned, you know, when you think about laicism, secularism, I think we need to make a distinction between laicism and secularism too. Most of the time, we use them interchangeably. As far as I'm concerned, laicism is that it's a separation of state and religion. Secularism is something else. A person is secular to the extent to which, according to my own definition and according to the definitions of some other people too, if that person uses his reasoning faculties rather than turning to religion and to religious personages when that person is going to make a decision. Now, when we think of a portion of secularists in Turkey, for them, laicism is a worldview, a philosophy of life. The Constitutional Court in Turkey made a number of rulings, and I shall now read for you their conception of laicism. Now, in Turkey too, laicism and secularism are interchangeably used. We have just one word in Turkey. It is laiklik. Some of us talk about secularism, but in the Constitution and as far as several people are concerned, it is laicism. Now, the Constitutional Court ruled, I quote, laicism is more than the separation of state and religion. Laicism is Turkey's philosophy of modernization. It is the last stage of the intellectual and organizational evolution of societies. If these are in danger, restrictions can be and should be brought to basic rights and liberties and to democracy. Our Council of State, Conseil d'État in France, also came up with such a definition of laicism, quote unquote. And our president from 2000 to 2007, Ahmet Necdet Sezer, had a similar view. Now we know that the basic or major issue of contention between the radical secularists and the pious revolves around this headscarf issue, the covering. Now, the secularists I have in mind consider it as a political symbol. They think headscarf is an indication of belief in dogmas, superstitions, and ignorance. Whereas the pious argue it's an obligation dictated by Islam. Some years ago, I'm not quite sure, there was this girl on a bus with a headscarf, and he started to talk with her friend in English. All the passengers turned to him in great amazement. You know, a person with a headscarf, how can he know, how can we talk in English? So what's going on? Why we have such a conception of Islam, such a conception of headscarf on the part of some secularists in Turkey? It seems to me that they have taken their cues from a particular approach of Atatürk back in the 1920s. Atatürk, the founder of Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, had thought that the Westerners looked down upon the Turks because of their clothing patterns. So he wanted to change all that. You know, he wanted Turkish women and Turkish men to dress themselves as the Westerners do. Consequently, for instance, some women in the early Republic competed in some athletic events in shorts, or you know, they had swimwear on the beaches, the modern swimwear on the beaches, and then they considered themselves as Ataturkists, as Westerners. So to begin with, the outer appearance of people became rather significant in the eyes of many people. Atatürk and his colleagues had set for Turkey the goal of catching up with the contemporary civilization. So they thought they had now become civilized because of this particular dress pattern. But Atatürk was trying to do something else, which particularly these secularists missed. Atatürk was not only place an emphasis on the outer appearance, but also on what you might call a sense. Atatürk was trying to bring about, I think it has been just mentioned, a cognitive revolution. Some people think Atatürk was trying to bring a cultural revolution. In my opinion, it wasn't cultural, but cognitive revolution. Atatürk wanted secularism, as I have designed, as I have defined it a moment ago, that the people should use their own reasoning faculties and not to turn to the book or the religious personages. So in my earlier work, I pointed out that Atatürk was trying to instruct people in Turkey in how to think, not in what to do. In fact, Atatürk several times pointed out that whatever he was doing in the 1930s, 1920s, would not be applicable in the later ages. As a consequence of which, some seculars, in my opinion, started to place emphasis on the question of what should be. What should be is, of course, contemporary civilization. as they have understood it, rather than on what is and why. So I have arrived at the conclusion relatively recently that here we are face to face with a normative mindset at the expense of analytical and empirical mindsets. Thus, in Turkey, I have observed a tendency toward rationalism rather than rationality on the part of several educated people. The rationalism presumes innate knowledge. So I am civilized, therefore I know. Rather than, whereas rationality is based, of course, on empirical observation and reasoning. So, these secularists have come to the conclusion that in modernizing Turkey, there should be no place really for religion, because religion is nothing but dogmas and superstitions. It is, of course, because of this that it has become very difficult to engage in dialogical debate between the radical secularists and the pious. So in more general terms, I think what I am saying is that in the West, empirical and analytical have shaped the normative, while in Turkey, normative left hardly any ground to the empirical and analytical. I thought this was a very original finding, conclusion on my part, but to my surprise, I have found out in my readings that in the late 1910s, an Ottoman great vizier, Said Halim Pasha, observed the following. He said, while in the West, now this is in the late 1910s, and Said Halim Pasha is a conservative pasha, he said, while in the West, mind moves from objects, read empirical reality, to thoughts. In Turkey, mind still moves from thought to objects. He then added, as a consequence, our aspirations are no more than illusions, which are very difficult to realize. And then I've asked myself, why is this so? Well, perhaps one explanation is that in the West, there took place an organic change, whereas in Turkey, it was an induced change. So the West changed by its own dynamics. West, you know, in the West, societies, politics transformed by its own dynamics. In Turkey, there have been efforts to replace one society and polity by another society and polity. So the Turks were emulating the West. So as a result, I tend to conclude on this particular point that the Westernization in Turkey turned out to be a process of mimicry, which of course obviated the need for empirical investigation and analysis. Instead, it helped develop a normative mindset. Whatever we have borrowed from Turkey, they are the best. You cannot have any argument on this. So it was not a selective adoption, as the Japanese had done, but a wholesale emulation and adoption of Western ways of doing things. Now, many of us think that in Turkey, we opted for total Westernization. There was a intellectual, again, in late 1910s, Cevdet Pasha, Ahmet Cevdet Pasha, if I'm not mistaken, he said we should westernize and we should adopt Western ways with its roses and thorns. And Atatürk was also, of course, for total westernization. At the turn of the century, in the early 20th century, there were some thinkers who thought, you know, we should adopt the technology from the West, but not the culture. But for Atatürk and his colleagues, total westernization should have been the goal that Turkey should have pursued. But when I think about this now, in terms of what I have already told you, that total westernization was, in fact, a partial westernization. We have borrowed the outer appearance of things, not the essence. Borrowings included neither an appreciation of the facilitating conditions why the West had industrialized so early as compared to Turkey, for instance, and some other countries. And we have not also become very curious about the thinking patterns, mentalities behind those changes. And then I tend to argue this mimicry I have mentioned had also been facilitated by an educational system in the Ottoman Empire, and to a great extent, even today in Turkey, where one memorized rather than learned. I can give you very interesting examples, if you like, in the question and answer period. And consequently, we became, or some secularists, or some educated in general, have become zealot defenders of the utopian, that is, the ideal types of what was emulated. This was, of course, also being mentioned by Said Halim Pasha in the late 1910s. Well, my conclusion here is, if we return to what we are investigating today, what we are supposed to investigate today and discuss, my conclusion is that while in general the separation of state and religion has been favorable to the emergence of a liberal and democratic political system, in Turkey, laicism, taken as state-defined secularism, has been an obstacle to the flourishing in that country of a liberal and democratic system. I better stop here so that we would have lots of time for questions and answers.
Could you say a little bit more about the point toward the end, right before your conclusion, when you connected the focus on memorization in Ottoman and in modern Turkish education with the tendency to latch on to and defend utopian ideals?
Well, you think West is doing some things and they are successful, so whatever they are doing is the right thing to do. So we should do the same thing. But in doing so, we are not really thinking, how come, you know, the West came to have such a civilization, such a political system, such an economy. And so we think that if you write these things down in our constitution or someplace else, we would have the same. So there is no analysis. You don't really pay any attention to really what happened in Turkey, in the West, and why. And consequently, you just memorize. You think you don't learn, because when you learn, you think, you see. When you learn what happened and why, when you memorize, you don't make that exercise, you don't make that mental exercise, you see. That's what I'm trying to say.
Nitin Deb, you talked about the radical secularists, the Kemalists that you actually have been studying for a long time. I'm just wondering, in terms of the wide spectrum of levels of piety and secularisms in Turkey, do you still consider Kemalist rigid secularism as the heart of political culture in Turkey, or do you also take different terminologies invented for more softer, more inclusive forms of secularism, like Ahmet Kuru would refer it as?
Passive secularism,
or less authoritarian, because, I mean, Kemalists are, to me, a shrinking category. It's also a generational thing. It's harder to find hardcore Kemalists in the younger generations than the senior, more senior generation, I think. I mean, you need to see with that.
First of all, we have to make a distinction between Kemalism and Atatürkism. Again, in Turkey, we use these terms interchangeably. In my recent work, I come to the conclusion that Kemalists are those who consider the early republic as a rather authoritarian in several ways, and that therefore Turkey today still suffers from that particular heritage. Now, Atatürkists are those who approve what Atatürk has done. They don't criticize. They have a rather favorable approach to Atatürk and what he has done. But again, those are the people who still think we can just repeat things, whatever has been done in the early republic. If you do the same things, we would be the best Atatürkists, and also it would be in the best interest of the country. The group of secularists I'm referring to, of course, favor assertive secularism that Ahmet Kuru, in his work, suggested this terminology, assertive secularism and passive secularism. In assertive secularism, you may have a laicist system of government. The state is sort of separated from religion, but religion is not separated from the state. So the state would have control over religion. How religion is perceived is a consequence of which, for instance, in Turkey, we have set up this Directorate of Religious Affairs, which is affiliated to the Prime Minister, and the Directorate of Religious Affairs appoint religious personages in mosques. They prepare the set texts so that those are delivered in the mosques on Fridays. The goal is to have a conception of Islam which would be friendly with modernization. I have found out, rather I know thought about it. There is this Professor Jehan Tual, who has a book entitled Passive Revolution. What he mentions in passing is very important. He has found out that in this district, in Istanbul, in the center of Istanbul, which had been very Islamist, there have been some changes taking place in recent decades. And these Islamists are turning into pious. And this has been happening because of the Justice and Development Party. And Jehan Tual argues that as a consequence of this particular transformation, these Islamists are turning into pious, and therefore they've started to pay more attention to those texts prepared by the Directorate of Religious Affairs. Now, this is another implication. You see, when we talked about secularism and laicism, these are two different phenomena. Secularism might lead to laicism, and laicism may lead to secularism. Now, in the very last example I shared with you, it seems to the extent to which we have laicism, we may begin to have more secularism. But if you look at the Turkish experience, I think in Turkey, because of the westernized education, for instance, starting very early in the Republic, and some other developments, the majority of the Turks have become secularism in the sense I have defined secularism, and as a consequence of which they start to support laicism. So this is not, of course, what your question made to think about these things. So we should distinctly separate laicism and secularism, and we should keep in mind that under certain circumstances, secularism, in fact, may lead to laicism, and on other occasions, laicism would facilitate the adoption of secularism on the part of some Muslims. I don't know if in the process I have discussed, I answered your question.
Professor, you mentioned earlier sort of a rough taxonomy of religious political persuasion, and I'm wondering to what extent, I'm just in general wondering the socioeconomic aspects of this. As you said before, in 1920, it sounds as though it did, as it did elsewhere in the region, take on a rather socioeconomic form where you have this sort of civilized elite adopting a very Western aesthetic, whereas traditional forms of dress became associated with ignorance, poverty. And I'm wondering if that's the case today, or if that's how it's perceived and imagined today.
But as I have pointed out, covering is not approved by a certain portion of secularists in Turkey. It is considered, as a sign of tradition, as a sign of backwardness, and all the rest of it. So what happens as a consequence is that those secularists do not attribute legitimacy. This is also very important to the legitimacy of the government. Do not attribute legitimacy through Recep Tayyip Erdogan, for instance, as prime minister. It is sort of just one-dimensional thought, you see. It is just developing and nothing else. So what's happening in Turkey is that the Justice and Development Party, from 2002 to the present, has been quite successful when it comes to economy, when it comes to Turkey's standing in the world, when Turkey is now considered as a regional power with some aspirations for becoming a global power. But the secularists I've been referring to are not paying any attention to any of these. No, they are still of the opinion that these people are not civilized, these people not modernized, these people are not progressives. But of course, it is very difficult to figure out why they are not paying any attention to some of the successes of Turkey under the Justice and Development Party government, which is also acknowledged not only by Turks, but by others. So this focus, you see, on Etzidar, and that's of course a symbol. Now, you know, we are going to have local elections, we are going to have national elections, there will be election of a new president, but the secularists I have in mind and the political party or parties that represent them are not coming up with new programs, are not criticizing economic problems, and therefore coming up with alternative programs. There has begun this shouting game between Prime Minister and the head of the main opposition party. I mean, if you read newspapers, they start calling each other names and nothing else. And Turkish media also has been divided, even on empirical issues, you see. One newspaper writes, this was what happened yesterday, other newspaper either does not pay any attention or says exactly the opposite. So it has become a very difficult task to be a professor of political science. And, you know, I'm supposed to follow up what's going on. But I'm just tired of, you see. And in any case, I've been so focused on the scope of, you know, the arguments I want to develop here, that I'm not really paying all that attention, because I'm reading the same thing every day. Sometimes I ask my students, which newspapers do you read and why? And they're at a loss then, you know, when they cannot come up with any persuasive answer. Good. Then I would ask why. And they have no answer to that
second part of the question, and I tell them, I make my question more specific. Which columnists do you read? I ask my students. And then I have to explain to them which columnists I'm reading and why. And I ask them, and I look at the title of the column. If I can guess what the columnist is going to say, I don't read it. And most of the time you can guess. There are very few columnists in Turkey that may say something different than what I have guessed. And then, of course, not here. You've been very good. You are not asking very specific questions. You are asking more general questions with which I can deal relatively easily. But sometimes, you know, you are called to, you know, take part in a panel on TV, for instance. You see, we were talking about this last night at dinner. They ask you very specific questions. I don't know. I don't know the answers to those questions. There is this particular saying, perhaps, very well tells what happens to a professor when he is on a panel with some journalists. The saying goes as follows. Journalists are those people who know less and less about more and more until they know nothing about everything. The professor is exactly the opposite. You say, professor is someone who knows more and more about less and less until he knows everything about nothing. So that's why I'm very pleased that you're asking questions that I know a little bit about. Any other questions? Yes, please.
I'm trying to think about how to phrase this. At the beginning of your presentation, you were sort of describing the way that people responded to survey questions. You know, would you favor the introduction of polygyny? Would you favor enforcement of Sharia, etc.? And it strikes me that those kinds of questions, in a way, are also, and I'm speaking of kind of ideal normative worldview, but those kinds of survey questions are, in a way, an ideal normative way of defining who's a religious person, in the sense that a lot of times people's lived experience of their religiosity is not necessarily in line with sort of textbook theology, if I can put it that way. So that I wonder if we can think about some of the polarization that's taking place in Turkish life, or American life for that matter, is talked about in terms of religion, but actually, I mean, in other words, people articulate their differences in terms of religion, but a lot of it is beyond the theological. It's more a cultural attitude towards life, and how one will begin even to measure what degree of tension there is along that spectrum.
Yes, I mean, in Turkey, another distinction we should make is between the religiously oriented and the conservative people. In Turkey, again, we don't make that distinction. You know, if we say conservative, muhafazakar in Turkish. Several people, you know, come to the conclusion that we are talking about religion. Now, the Justice and Development Party, as I pointed out, considers itself as a conservative, democratic political party. And Justice and Development Party, this is another thing I would like to point out concerning that political party. And if you have already have not arrived at the conclusion, but now reveal that I am a great supporter of Justice and Development Party. What they do is they have a balanced approach to so many issues, including conservatism, including religion, including democracy, including change, including globalization. If you read the party programs of several political parties, they usually approach these phenomena from different perspectives. I mean, from one perspective. But when it comes to Justice and Development Party, it is very, very interesting that they approach these issues in a very balanced manner. For instance, on state and religion relationship, this is what you read in their program. They write, freedom of conscience is of utmost importance. This freedom also involves the freedom of living one's religion in accordance with one's belief. The state should not be able to impose its own dogma upon society. The state should be equidistant to all religions and thoughts, making possible their peaceful coexistence. Then they continue. The state too should be freed from the clutches of any kind of dogma. Forming a political party in the name of religion, or to even give such an image, is the greatest harm one can render to religion. Religion is a common belief system. Nobody has a right to use it for partisan purposes and thus give rise to divisions in society and politics. And nobody has a right to try to make others more pious. Concerning traditions and conservatism, in politics, one may take one's cues from traditional values. One should not, however, transform the latter into an ideology. Reflection in politics of one's personal views and feelings based on religion is only to be expected. However, it should not clash with laicism. And turning to tradition, order, and freedom. Let me just also read this. Freedom and order are not phenomena that negate each other. In fact, one cannot have one without the other. Yet the freedom to tinker with customs, traditions, norms of morality, and religious life cannot be approved. On the other hand, society is not individual's coffin, but its cradle. Such institutions as the family, school, civil societal organizations enable the individual to defend his or her rights and freedoms against the state. Have I answered your question?
I guess, in other words, so you've answered my question in the sense that that's the party's, that's the AKP's position on that. But what I mean to say is, I observe both in Turkish life and oddly in American life too, I mean, I often am struck by parallels between the two, that we it's something that you also were mentioning in your presentation, that cultural wars or values discourse takes the place in some sense of discussion of actual, you know, material and empirical problems. We spend a lot of time talking about traditional family values and not a lot of time talking about, you know, the collapse of the industrial infrastructure, for instance. So there's kind of two things there. One thing is that instead of thinking about the cultural debate itself as one between religious and non-religious, what else is really at stake in that cultural debate? Besides religion or in addition to religion. And then also why have cultural debates taken the place of debates about the actual material conditions or political conditions of our societies? I mean, those are, I mean, I don't actually expect anybody to have an answer to that. I'm just interested in your thoughts, since I have no answer.
Justice and Development Party would like to bring back some cultural values, if you may call them cultural values, from the Ottoman Empire. For instance, they place a great emphasis on the family. Family, of course, played a very significant role in the Ottoman Empire. You know, you had the center and then the society, but you did not have some civil society organizations, this or that. But when you talked about the periphery, you really talked about the family and the neighborhood. In the Ottoman Empire, you did not have an aristocracy. You did not have the bourgeoisie. Now, as we are all aware of, the fact that bourgeoisie, the aristocracy, have been the carriers of some values, and then those values have been internalized by a great number of people in society. You know, for aristocracy, honor is very important. For the bourgeoisie, among other things, punctuality is very important. You know, you have to produce and get them to a certain place on time. Now, we did not have those. We had Kemalism, but Kemalism has not been a roadmap in daily life. So we were left with religion and some educated reading, Western philosophers, etc. For AKP, and in fact its predecessors, it was very important, they thought, that people should derive certain virtues, certain roadmaps from Islam, so that and Turkey would benefit from it. For instance, hard work is very much emphasized in Islam and in other monotheistic religions. Education is very much emphasized in Islam. There is a saying, if the education is China, go and get it, you see. Hard work, justice is very important. So the Justice and Development Party. And so, for instance, from time to time, Recep Tayyip Erdogan making some statements which is not in the best diplomatic practice, where he comes out and speaks his mind when it comes to Israel-Palestine issue or to Turkey-Israel relations, for instance. The very first religious-oriented political party was set up in 1970. It was the National Order Party. In fact, the leader of the then Naqshbandi, the then leader of the Naqshbandi religious order, came up with this idea that in Turkey one should have a religious-oriented political party. Because that political party would place emphasis on such virtues that Islam teaches, as a consequence of which, in fact, the Turkish economy would develop. As a consequence of which, in fact, we would have a very big political crisis that Turkey has been facing all the time. And as a consequence, the state also would leave us alone. Of course, Justice and Development Party is no Nationalist Order Party, because at the time, the religious-oriented political parties in Turkey thought there was a basic incompatibility between religion and secularism. But as time went by, these religious-oriented political parties came to the conclusion that religion should not poke its nose into state affairs and the state should not interfere in religious affairs. And of course, this is what the Justice and Development Party also thinks. But for them, for instance, communalized piety is another important matter that the Justice and Development Party emphasizes, which is against the Cameras, because the Cameras wanted to, place for religion was the individual conscience. But now communalized piety is another thing that Justice and Development Party is for. They are for families, because in their opinion, families are the carriers of Islam, but not, political Islam, it's individualized Islam.
You mentioned the fact of mimicry several times in your talk, and I wanted to ask questions about that. Well, see if I'm understanding this right. Because it seems that the mimicry of the West that has taken place, and it seems that the part of the, at least in part, the weaknesses or the problems of secularism is predicated on that mode of mimicry. And yet at the same time, this kind of mimicry, the kind of things that we're talking about, it never takes place in, as it were, a kind of an even or a open playing field, but rather under duress. Right? I'm thinking particularly in relation to Japan. I should say that I don't really study Japan as a profession. That's not my field, but I just have known a bit about it by growing up. Because that, too, was always criticized for the sort of mechanical mimicry. And particularly, this map earlier than the case of Turkey, perhaps, but by the end of the 19th century, I've seen some of the writings by Americans and others that this is a nation of the wholesale mimics. And in fact, that their great or seemingly great success was that this is essentially a nation of spirit possession. I mean, basically, the Western spirit has possessed them, and that this is their national character, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, but obviously, all that mimicry really takes place under a tremendous duress. I mean, in other words, when you see a certain kind of powerful weapon of whatever is directed at you, you need to come up with something that counteracts it very quickly. And I think that's where, in the case of Japan, they looked over Germany or Prussia, looking at the success of that nation within the course of the 19th century, and they never looked back. And they become exactly, they do the military that way, they do the bureaucracy that way, and they build industry that way. And it, at that time, it seems like why, for example, Christianity didn't make its inroads there. because it was not because of some native resistance to that foreign religion, but because they realized that the most powerful nation, or what they thought as the most powerful nation, was utilizing not Christianity. In fact, Christianity was being put down. It is Hegel and Kant on one hand, and Spencer and Darwin that they need to imitate. So this seemed to be a fairly well-documentable choices that they made. So therefore, they made secularism as a choice, but under duress. I take it that it is obviously very much a similar kind of power dynamics that was going on in the last day of the Ottoman Empire. I'm thinking particularly of that marvelous and tremendous chandelier in Dolmabahce, which seems like this is a kind of a last Ottoman answer to the West by totally overpowering it. Right? Coming up with only with this enormous thing. I'm so impressed by that image of it. And that's what made me think of it. But I wondered if you had something more to say about this kind of the duress aspect of it and what it produces.
My comments on Japan. Draws upon this chapter, Japan, environmental and foreign contributions. In this edited volume, Political Modernization in Japan and Turkey, edited by Robert E. Ward and Dan Petrasso, published Princeton University Press in 1964. The author is Robert A. Scalapino. So in this chapter, Scalapino wrote the following: the process of modernization is vastly more complex than the mere copying of a textile machine or the employment of a foreign technician. In the political field particularly, the mechanical borrowing of foreign institutions and procedures nearly always ended in failure. In the final analysis, Japanese modernizers in the political field learn by their own experiences through a process of trial and error. They made many mistakes, but it was the willingness to experiment, the essential pragmatism characterizing the leadership, that gave the political modernization of Japan its most progressive qualities, especially in the Meiji era. So this was, you see, I was trying to make a comparison between the Turkish case and the Japanese case. So in your case, it was selective modernization. In the case of Turkey, it was non-selective modernization, if you like. By the way, when it comes to Christianity and Islam, of course, the basic difference is that in Christianity, this world owes someone else, that world owes still someone else, but in Islam, at least in classical Islam, no such distinctions were made. So, therefore, taking into account these differences, you see, by taking these differences into account, I have developed the argument I have shared with you this morning.
I hate to stop, but we need to have a break before our next panelist from Turkey. Thank you so much.
We thank you for listening to or viewing our podcast. For more information and for other podcasts, please see our website, divinity.uchicago.edu/podcasts. Copyright, the University of Chicago Divinity School.